All right, that brings us to our speaker. Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Mary Ellen from Point Pleasant, New Jersey.
Hi, guys. My name is Mary Ellen Harrison. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jeff, for having me come out to speak, and thanks, Abby, for coming with me. It's always an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Not always a pleasure, but an honor and a privilege. And I just say that honestly, you know, the longer I stay sober, you know, sometimes I'm not as willing or like jumping at the bit to like drive 2 hours to come speak at an AA meeting, but I'm so grateful for good teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous who have told me that if and when possible, always show up. And that there is absolutely no way I could ever pay forward, you know, give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what was given to me. I can try to pay it forward, though. And, you know, what's been given to me by Alcoholics Anonymous, by you guys, by good sponsorship, that's romantic, you know, and by a relationship with God through the 12 steps has been absolutely a brand new life. You know, I didn't get my old life back. I have a sponsor who used to talk about, getting a bright and shiny new life, and that's absolutely my experience. The first sponsor I had pointed out in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, that they talk about recreating your life, because when I got here, I was pretty young, and I saw a lot of you old people talking about all the things you got back by coming to AA, and I would sit here and be like, well, I don't really want any of my life back, you know, like, I'm so grateful to a sponsor who pointed out that what I can do here is create the life that I want and that God intends me to have. And that's really incredible because I have not gotten almost anything back, but I have gotten this incredibly full, passionate, purposeful, joyful life. That is more than I ever even thought I wanted, and really just fantastic. So let me just start and say I have a sobriety date. It's May 7th, 2007. So in a couple weeks, if I don't drink and I don't die, I'll be celebrating 9 years, which is pretty miraculous, you know. It's pretty miraculous for a girl like me, and I really think it's testimony to that we do recover. You know, and we recover at any age, which is really important to say. I got here when I was 21 years old, and a lot of people told me, you know, like, are you sure you really have a problem? Like, let alone I was like a homeless prostitute before I got sober. Like, maybe it was a phase, like, you couldn't possibly be alcoholic. Like, you're so young, or, you know, like, people who, like, looked down at me and said, like, you know, I spilled more than you drank. Like, well, you should have been less sloppy. Like, you know, like, and I just say that because, like, and if you've ever said anything like that, shame on you, you know, and I'm so grateful for good sponsorship and someone who told me, don't you dare let anyone take your seat here from you, you know, and the big book talks about it specifically for women, you know, that we can become the real deal alcoholic in a shorter period of time, having drank less. And that's absolutely my experience. So I'm going to tell you, I'm a little nostalgic. I've spoken at Quakertown a couple times. I spoke at an Axe here, did a really terrible job. And also I've spent some time with some of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous here. And I'm really feeling a little nostalgic about Tom Flynn tonight for whatever reason. And I was thinking, you know, so I always say a prayer before I get up at the mic to talk to you guys, and my prayers have gotten more and more simple the longer I've stayed sober. You know, I used to pray, like, for the wisdom and the knowledge and the intuition to, like, you know, share the message, and you know, they've gotten, like, so simple, like, just thy will be done, you know, and I often need to also ask God to remove what I think you guys need to know so that I can share what He needs you to know, because my ego still is huge and tells me that, like, I need to have a really fabulous podium talk so that you guys like me, right? And to bring that back to Tom, I remember him saying to me constantly, like, you can be a fool for Alcoholics Anonymous. You've been a fool for less. And And so sometimes my simple prayer is, you know, if I need to make a fool of myself at the mic, you know, in order to reach somebody, like, allow my ego to be okay with that. And I just really love Alcoholics Anonymous. And hated people who talk about gratitude, because I believe that gratitude's an action word. But, like, when I think about my life today, I am so overwhelmed with gratitude, because I believe we get to live two lives in one lifetime. You know, I really believe that we get to live two lives in one lifetime. And what an incredible blessing that is. And I also believe the reason why we're able to do that is because we have a calling and a purpose. And that's just an incredible thing to walk around with, knowing that I have. So life was pretty hard for me pretty early on, right? I believe that for me, I suffered with spiritual malady, which was the precipitator for me to pick up a drink way before I picked up a drink. And I don't need to get into a debate with, you know, whether you're born with alcoholism or not. I don't know. I don't care. I'm not a doctor. What I know is that for me, way young, like 5, 6 years old, I have memories of being uncomfortable, feeling less than, wanting more, feeling uncomfortable in my own skin, you know, gravitating towards adults because I didn't feel like I fit in with my peers. Just like, and if you'd asked me at that age, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that, like, what was wrong or pinpoint it. But, like, my earliest memories are those of being uncomfortable and desperately wanting to fit in, desperately wanting to be okay, and doing things in an effort to get okay. So I'm going to tell my favorite story. Which if you've ever heard me talk, you've heard it before. But I think it's the most important story for me about my alcoholism. And when I was about 6 or 7, my mother decided to go back to grad school. And we live forwards and we understand backwards. So I clearly understand now that this was a decision that she made for the good of her, the good of me. She was trying to support her family better. She was trying to, you know, do the best thing for us. And that's not how I experienced it, though. As a young girl, I experienced it as abandonment, you know. I experienced it as, you know, I used to spend a lot of time with my mom, and now I spend a lot of time with a babysitter. And I had the most fabulous babysitter. Her name was Billy Shube. She was an older woman who lived on the 5th floor. I grew up in New York City. And, you know, Billy did whatever a good babysitter does. She fed me, she clothed me, she played with me, she, you know, put me to bed, she, whatever it is a good babysitter does. But for whatever reason, and now I understand my own spiritual malady, it wasn't enough, you know, and I was still left 5, 6, 7 years old feeling as if I needed more. And we live forwards, we understand backwards. So had you asked, like, little 7-year-old Marielle, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that, right? But I can clearly see that today. And so what would happen is I would steal Billy's glasses. And I would steal her glasses, and I would hide them. And she would notice relatively quickly that she was missing her glasses, and she would ask little Marielle to help her look for them. And being the helpful little girl that I was always ready to help her. And seeing that I had actually been the one who had hidden them, I was always able to find them before her. And so I tell you this, there's a purpose to telling you guys this story, besides that I'm totally a crackpot. What happened when I would present Billy with her glasses was the magic for me. And in that very moment, she would shower me with love, affection, attention, and praise. And, like, I get chills just telling that story because, for me, that's my whole life. And that's my alcoholism. That's why I drank. That's why I had sex. That's why I eat and throw up. That's why I shop. That's why I that's why I do any of those things, because I'm looking for more, right? My alcoholism is not about alcohol. It has a lot of alcohol in it. My alcoholism is not about alcohol. It's about the fact that I am uncomfortable right now, right here, in my skin with what's going on. And I'm unable to get okay on my own. And so isn't that just human nature, right? Like, we all just kind of want to be okay, right? Like, the goal is to, like, be able to feel content and feel whole and feel complete and feel safe. And so alcoholism, human, spiritual condition, mixture of all three of them, you know, at a very young age, I became willing to do these extreme, bizarre things in an attempt to get more from you, right? So that's my first memory of trying to utilize a human power to get okay, you know? And really, that's my story from then and still until now, because I would be lying if I stood up here and said, like, I am 100% God-reliant, because that's simply not the truth. I'm maybe 20% God-reliant, if I want to be honest with you guys. And so I don't start drinking until I'm, you know, as late in life. I was like 9 or 10 years old. But I really needed a drink by that time, you know, and I'm participating in all sorts of other behaviors, you know, that are weird and bizarre, like running down the school, you know, hallway and like tearing down the bulletin boards, like, you know, stealing, you know, making out with boys. There's just like all, being truant, stealing stuff from girls I went to school with and like wearing it in front of them, like thinking they wouldn't know, like all sorts of weird behaviors, right? Which also looked very clearly like mental illness to my mother. So that meant that at a very young age, I was being shuffled from doctor to doctor and being put on different medications. And I don't have an opinion about medication. I do know for me that my alcoholism mirrored mental illness. And that, of course, it looked like I should be on different medications because I was full of fear, anxiety, panic, OCD, like, you know, kleptomania, you know, defiance, all of these things, which were for me just symptoms of my spiritual malady. And so before I even pick up a drink, I'm getting into a lot of trouble. And I don't have a clear memory of my first drink. I often want to like make one up that's like really fabulous so that I have a cool story to tell you guys. But the truth is that what I do remember is I remember at a really young age going into mom's liquor cabinet and having like one of those Chinese takeout soup containers and like just like mixing whatever I thought I could get away with. And so that meant that like this concoction that I was consuming was like tequila, vermouth, peach schnapps, gin, and, you know, Kahlua, like, you know, like something really grotesque. And the reason why I think that's important is because what that says to me, like my first drink wasn't at like a keg party in the woods with a red solo cup and like I wanted to look cool in front of the boys. Like I was clearly drinking for the effect produced by alcohol, right? There was nothing sexy. There was nothing alluring. You know, I was drinking because of what alcohol did to me and what alcohol did for me. And that's my whole experience with alcohol. You know, I drink as much as I can, as fast as I can, to get where I need to go. You know, and where I need to go is anywhere but right here, right now. And a lot of people talk about, you know, they drank and they felt sexy or smart or they danced better or they drove better, which is probably delusional. But you know, that's not my experience. I didn't feel any of that when I drank. For me, what I got is I just got okay. Right? And so I was no longer paralyzed by this fear that I wasn't thin enough, or I wasn't pretty enough, or I wasn't funny enough, or I wasn't smart enough, or I didn't dance good or drive well enough. Like those, that constant paralyzing, what we call in Alcoholics Anonymous, self-centered fear, was diminished through alcohol. And that's what I was looking for. You know, I was looking for the ability to just stand in my reality with whatever it was and just be okay. And the truth is, guys, that's the same thing I'm looking for in recovery, right? I'm looking for the ability to stand in my reality, whatever it is, and just be okay, you know? And I'll tell you, if I didn't get that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here. No, I absolutely wouldn't be here. So plug for AA, like, you should stay, you can get okay. But, you know, drugs are a really big part of my story, I really respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved, at service, at the general service level, and I believe that our traditions are what protect you guys from me and what allow us to stay here. And I want AA to be here in 20 years and 50 years and 500 years. However, I also think it's just important for you to know that I use drugs, because when I got here, I didn't know if I was alcoholic, right? I wasn't qualified yet through the doctor's opinion with the phenomenon of craving and the mental obsession, and I just knew that, like, I'd been doing dope and smoking crack for a long time, and I knew that that was a problem. And I'm grateful that someone stood at the podium and talked about the fact that they had an experience with drug use, because had I not heard that, I might not have stayed long enough to be qualified. And I want to give you guys a snapshot of what it looked like at the end, because I don't want to talk for 30 minutes about what my drinking was like. I believe that we all probably have similar or not similar experiences, but I really want to talk to you guys about my recovery. So I'll tell you a couple stories about my drinking, and then we'll jump to getting sober, maybe before 8:30. So senior year of high school, right? I start drinking with these guys, and I just want to feel a part of, right? Like, that's all I've ever wanted to feel. In AA, not in AA, young, teenager, I just want to feel a part of. And so I find these guys who are from the town next to where my mom lives, and my high school years were in a pretty affluent, upper middle class, white suburban community, and the town next to us was a lower middle class, maybe low income, ghetto. And so I found the guys who had like graduated a couple years ago and were like living in their parents' garages or basements, who like didn't go to college, they were going to rehab, going to jail. I was like, you guys are awesome. You are who I want to hang out with all the time. People going to college, not so cool. And with these guys, I would have told you that like these were going to be my friends forever, like ride or die, like listen to Biggie and smoke blunts until, forever, And so there's a point to this, I swear. And it's not, I'm losing my point here. So there's a story that I really want to tell you guys. So this is like toward the end of my senior year in high school. I'm hanging out with these guys. We're drinking all the time. And we're having a lot of fun, which I think is important to say, right? Because I had a lot of fun drinking. And I had a lot of fun getting high. And had I not... And I'm so grateful I did, not because I have memories, but because it kept me drunk long enough that I didn't kill myself, right? So the consequences, though, got pretty bad pretty fast. So I'm hanging out with these guys, and, I guess my senior year of high school, I was 5'1", 110 pounds maybe, and one of these guys, his name is Jay, he's like 6'5", 240, and he has an idea, and he's like, let's go shot for shot. And I'm like, that's a great idea, right? I can totally beat you. That speaks to the fact that, like, I just want you to like me, right? And even if it's a terrible idea, I'm going to say yes, right? So we're in the backseat of my car, and we each have a bottle of Jaeger, and we each have a bottle of Malibu. And I remember, like, shot for shot all the way through the Jaeger. And then things get, like, a little fuzzy. My next clear memory is waking up to, like, a rapping on the back window of my car and me, like, coming to. And I'm, like, covered in vomit. My pants are around my ankle. And no one is there except this cop rapping on the window, right? And I have severe alcohol poisoning. I'm rushed to the ER. My mom is called. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. And the most important part of this story is that these friends, these, like, ride-or-die friends, right, they're gone. They've left me for dead. That's not the important part of the story, though. The important part of the story is a week later, I'm hanging out with these people, And I'm not confronting them. I'm not like, how could you do this? This is morally wrong. Like, you should be better friends. Like, that conversation never took place, right? And the reason why I think that's so important to share with you is that absolutely did my alcoholism take things away like cars and cell phones and, you know, college education and thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars. But really what my alcoholism took from me is things like dignity and integrity and self-esteem and self-worth. And I became willing to give those things away really early. You know, and I'm glad for good sponsorship that taught me that I gave those things away. You know, those things were not taken from me. I gave those things away, and I gave them away because there was no price I wasn't willing to pay for what alcohol did to me and what alcohol did for me. And that's just the beginning, you know, like of really severe consequences. And had you asked me at the time, I wouldn't have considered that severe. You know, but what my drinking looks like by the time I'm getting sober is it looks like getting pregnant and having a miscarriage in a dirty motel room, unwilling to go to the hospital because I need to keep drinking and I need to keep getting high. And like bleeding out in this dingy motel simply because I'm unwilling to stop drinking. You know, what my drinking looks like in the end is getting brutally raped at gunpoint and held hostage for 8 hours. Like what my drinking looks like in the end is me in the fetal position, crying, because I hate who I am, and alcohol's not working anymore. You know, and no matter how much I drink, and no matter how much I use, I just can't get okay. And our book talks about this as the jumping off point. You know, it talks about when you can't live with alcohol, but you can't live without alcohol. And for me, and I've been in some pretty precarious, like, scary situations, this is the scariest situation I've ever been in. You know, when the only thing I know that has ever allowed me to function, albeit, you know, poorly, but function, to breathe, to look at myself in the mirror, to talk to you, the only thing that I've ever known to work has stopped working. And if you've had that experience, you know what it's like. And it's terrifying. Because I didn't know that, like, there was recovery. I didn't know that hope was available. I didn't know that there was a new way of life. You know, and I'll tell you, had you asked me what my greatest fear was at that point, I wasn't scared of, like, getting shot in a drug deal gone wrong. I wasn't scared of overdosing. I wasn't scared of dying at all. I was scared of being like that woman who I was getting high with, who'd been getting high since she was 18 and she was 50, you know, and living for 30 more years, day in and day out, hating myself, hating you, and doing these shameful, degrading, illegal, harmful things. That's what I was scared of. And I believe that grace hits us all evenly, right? And I think sometimes we do a disservice in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a lot of opinions. I'm going to share some of them. Alcoholics Anonymous has none, so this is not an AA opinion. But I think we often do a disservice by not really talking about what grace is, and it can sound kind of like fluffy, like, oh, the grace of God, it's so lovely. I believe that the way I've been taught, grace of God is an unwarranted gift. And so that means that we all get it whether or not we're deserving. And that also means that we get it drunk or sober, you know, fat or skinny, gay or straight, Asian or Latin or whatever, green. Like, grace lands on everybody evenly. So what does that mean, though, right? If we all have grace, why don't we all get and stay sober? And my experience is that the way grace shows up in my life is in a couple ways. One, it shows up as a moment of clarity, right? Or two, it shows up as outside circumstances intervening in perhaps a way that isn't so pleasant in the moment, like jail or treatment or whatever. And so these moments of clarity, I've had tons of them while drinking. Right? I remember once being in an opium den in Soho, and God knows what I was doing or who I was doing, and I remember going to the bathroom and, like, catching a glimpse of my eyes in the mirror and, like, having this moment where I was so taken aback by who I was and where I was and what I was doing, and like having this moment of like, I got to get out of here. I got to change. I got to do something. And I have an ex-boyfriend who talks about this as, you know, like our alcoholism is as if we're in a barrel, right? And the barrel is dark and scary, but it's also kind of warm and comforting, right? And these moments of clarity, the lid of the barrel comes off and like we poke our head out and it's like bright and beautiful and there's green pastures, but like it's also kind of cold and unfamiliar. So most of the time we just jump right back in the barrel. And that's what I did in this, you know, in Soho that night. I like had this moment and then I was like, screw it, too much, too heavy, I gotta go. And I went right back to what I was doing. But I believe that that was a moment of grace, right? I also believe that how I got into treatment was a moment of grace, right? I had a married drug dealing boyfriend who told me that if I went to drug treatment, he would leave his wife. And I was like, well, that's sweet. She's a bitch anyway. You should leave her, you know? And you know, I say that with some humor now, you know, but like the truth was like I had no intention of getting sober. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't even really want to marry Charlie, you know? Like, it was just circumstances that allowed me to do something different, right? And I believe that that was grace. So I actually don't get sober at that treatment center, but I still believe it was grace, and it was the beginning of me knowing that there was a different way of life, you know? Because had I known a couple years earlier, I might have gotten sober a couple years earlier. And I don't like regret that or wish that I had, because I strongly believe that the things that I did have allowed me to become who I am today, and I wouldn't want it any other way. And I have no shame and I have no regret. However, thinking in hindsight, had I known that like I could change my life and I could live this beautiful life, like maybe things could have been different. And that's why I do some of the work I do professionally today with young kids, because I think recovery needs to be visible. People need to know that just because you go down one path doesn't mean you need to stay on that path forever. And so I get to this treatment center, and what happens is a couple things that are not of me, right? So I'm at treatment in Pennsylvania. Normally I say that I'm not in Pennsylvania. So I'm at treatment here in your state, and I was really barely in treatment because I was in detox for like 17 days, and I guess my individual therapist, you know, at the end of the 28 days said something along the lines of like, you should really go for extended care treatment. And I share this story with you because, remember, I went to treatment so Charlie would leave his wife, right? Not so I would stop smoking crack. And there was no intention on any major life shift, right? So when she said that, I should have said, no, thank you. Like, thanks for your time. But what came out of my mouth was okay. And I'm of the belief that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and really anywhere, the most spiritual thing I can say is okay. Because it means that there's a level of surrender there. And for me, that's huge, because I've got a lot of really good ideas and a lot of ifs and buts and what ifs and why. And for me, just to say okay is really a sign of surrender. And so here I go off to Florida, which might have also had something to do with the surrender. It was like February and I was homeless, but that's neither here or there. So here I go off to Florida, and I'm in this extended care program. And I think this is important because this, for me, speaks very loudly about the mental obsession with alcoholism and how, for me, the most dangerous time for me is sober. I never get drunk because I'm drunk. I get drunk because I'm sober. And being sober is intolerable. And so so I'm here for about 90 days at this extended care treatment, removed from alcohol and all other mind and mood-altering substances. And what happens is this boy shows up. And that's the beginning of a really bad story for me every time. And what's different about this boy is that Tyler and I had gotten drunk together once in Connecticut. And here we were now in this treatment center 1,500 miles away. And I was absolutely positive that we were like soulmates and God had sent him there and he was sent and it was God's will and we were going to live happily ever after. And living forwards, understanding backwards, I absolutely do believe that that he was sent by God, just not in the way I thought. Because, you know, the series of circumstances, fortunate or unfortunate, that unfolded as a result of Tyler showing up is what gets me sober. And so Tyler and I clearly make the only decision that was available, which was we were going to run away together. And so we, like, absconded from treatment. And it was very romantic the first, like, 5 hours. You know, we, like, ran to the beach, and we had, like, the keys around our necks with our rooms. And, like, we threw them in the ocean, and the sun was setting, and it was perfect. Until it wasn't perfect, which was about 20 minutes later, you know. And the reason why that's so important is because, you know, within a couple of hours I'm drinking, and within a couple of more hours I'm in a dirty motel with men I don't know, sleeping with them so that I can get what I need. And, you know, Candace Moore, who's a speaker out of the Pacific Group in L.A., she often talks about, if I've done it before, I'll do it again. And that's absolutely my experience. It didn't matter that I was 90 days removed from alcohol. You know, I'd done it before, and I would do it again. You know, and so to me, that speaks loudly about the mental obsession that alcoholism, the hold that it has over me, and that it's really not about a physical connection to alcohol or drugs. And so what happens is it gets even less romantic. I find out that Tyler is like just like a hobo, and he doesn't really have any intention of us like getting to a home ever. He's like, oh, we'll just like jump on freight trains and, you know, like live off the land, and which sounded really romantic at the time. I was like, oh, like Arlo Guthrie will play in the background, and the sun will always be setting, and I'll have like a stick with a satchel, and we'll have picnics, and that was not at all what happened, you know. On May 7th, 2007, which is my sobriety date, we had jumped on a freight train, which, so you know, is very dangerous, and I would highly not recommend doing it. But we had jumped on a freight train, and a couple hours after, we were woken up by the New Smyrna Beach Police Department. Apparently, it's called interference with a railroad, and it's a felony. And the New Smyrna Beach Police Department was not impressed with us, and we were escorted to Volusia County Correctional Facility. And that's important because that morning when I woke up, or I don't know if I woke up, I might have been up for days at that point, but I had no intention of getting sober that day, and I certainly had no intention of getting and staying sober for 9 years, you know. Yet here I am, and that is my sobriety date. And so it's important to tell you, though, that, like, when I got to jail, I was kicking and screaming, right? And still no intention of getting sober, which, again, speaks loudly to the mental obsession surrounding alcoholism, right? Normal person has these pretty severe consequences. Their thinking is like, hey, maybe I should do something differently. Maybe alcohol's a problem. You know, maybe I need some help, right? My thinking, on the other hand, is like, how can I get out of here? When can I get out of here? And who do I know in the area that I can call so I can get what I need to get to be okay? Right? And so my mom does probably the bravest thing, one of the bravest things she's ever done, which is she lets me sit in jail for a while. And I'll tell you, jail's not fun if you've never been there. But I remember being like, to give you a picture, I wish I could show you guys my mugshot. It's pretty scary. But just to give you a picture of the state that I arrived in jail, I had this roommate who insisted on corn rolling, if that's an adverb, corn rolling my hair because it was in dreads from the lack of care I took of myself. You know, like, I was just absolutely no priority except drinking. I didn't care about the way I looked. I didn't care about the way I smelled. I didn't care about my clothes. I didn't care about if I had shoes on my feet. I didn't care about who you were. All I cared about was what you had. And so my mom leaves me for about 5 weeks in jail. And eventually she comes around, like she always does, you know, and she's like, okay, we have a plan, right? I'm going to come. I'm going to pick you up. We're going to fly back to New York. You're going to go to an outpatient treatment center, and you're going to get well. And that sounds like a pretty sweet plan, right? So I'm like, all right, let's do it. And so we talked about grace, and I talked to you about what I think my definition of grace is. But I also said something, I think, along the lines of, like, so then why don't all of us get sober if we all have grace? And I believe that in order to get and stay sober, grace has to be accompanied with an opening of your eyes, a closing of your mouth, and an opening of your heart. And an action that is different than anything you've ever done before. And so so my mom comes to Florida, and she has these plane tickets, and we're on our way to the airport, and I have this moment of clarity, where I do something different, you know, and I just look at her and I say, Mom, I can't go with you. If I go with you, I'm going to drink, and if I drink, I'm going to die. And those words are not of me, right? And then my mother's next actions are also not of her, right? She says, okay, kid, you're on your own. And she leaves me in Florida, homeless, right? And I can't even imagine what that plane ride was like for her. You know, I'm not a parent yet, but I believe that you can only be as happy as your saddest child. And I can imagine her being on that plane not knowing if she's ever going to see her 21-year-old daughter again, you know. And so what happens then is the magic, really, right? And the magic is that I wanted to stay sober 1% more than I wanted to get drunk. You know, I'd been in treatment in the area locally, and I knew that there was like an AA clubhouse, and I went to it, and I rose my hand, and I said, hi, my name's Mariel, I'm an alcoholic. I just got out of jail, I have nowhere to live, and I really want to drink. And that's probably the most honest thing I've ever said, still to this day. And what happened then is that the magic that happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? The magic here is that I come in smelling with like a duffel bag full of a couple items of clothing and a teddy bear I got in treatment and a big book and angry and mean and fearful. And you guys surround me and you guys love me, you know, and you guys tell me that it's going to be okay. And my experience is that I got everything that I needed once I came to AA. You know, people put me on their couch, they bought me clothes, they bought me meals, you know, which isn't always the right move, and our book talks about that. But, you know, I got absolutely everything I needed. And for me, that's when the recovery process started. And I was thrown into service very quickly. I also didn't have a lot, like, going on. So, you know, I did, like, you know, 90 meetings in 2 weeks, you know. Like, I just kind of, like, hung out at the clubhouse. But they really got me into service. I was chairing meetings. I was sweeping the floor. I was making the coffee. I was, you know, greeting. Anything that they could have me do, I was doing. I remember, you know, so I probably got out of jail in the middle of June, and I remember they, like, threw me on the July 4th planning picnic committee, and they, like, had me counting the money at the door for this picnic, and you know, I'm, like, 2 months sober at the time, you know, like, maybe 60 days, no, not 60, like, 3 weeks out of jail, like, at this picnic with thousands of alcoholics at John Prince Park in Lake Worth, Florida, like, counting thousands of dollars. And I'm like, these idiots, like, I could get so high right now, you know? And only through sticking around a little while do I understand why they had me do that, right? That they made a decision that maybe I was going to take off with the money, but maybe I wasn't. And by putting me to work that day, they just might save my life, you know? And those are the types of decisions that we make here in Alcoholics Anonymous, decisions that are not of self, decisions that are truly altruistic for the, you know, putting our lives on the line for our brothers and sisters. And so I really involved in service, and I believe that that saved my life, right? Because I really wanted to drink. And the most dangerous time for us is sober, I believe, you know? And so I believe we do a disservice to the newcomer. This is a Mariel Harrison opinion, by telling the newcomer that they should get a sponsor who has what they want. Because I believe that we don't know what we want when we get here, right? Or if we do know what we want, it's really skewed, right? And so I was told to get a sponsor who had what I wanted. So I found a woman who had a red Mustang, who had recently bought a house, who had recently got engaged, and was 16 years removed from alcohol and drugs, hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, well, that is sweet. I want all of that. What I wasn't told, and this is what I believe we should do, and you don't have to do what I say, is I believe we should tell the newcomer to get a sponsor who has worked the 12 steps that are outlined in the big book and has had a spiritual awakening and a relationship with God. And my belief is that this woman who I asked to sponsor me is not a real alcoholic, because she did not get me working the steps. And for someone like me, who has lost the only solution that they've ever had to deal with reality, to deal with myself right here, right now, I need a solution as soon as freaking possible. You know, and I don't want to get into an argument about how fast you should work the steps or how many days you should have to sponsor, because that's between you and your sponsor. But for me, I was dying as an everyday, multiple time a day member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I am in the halfway house, like, you know, stealing from the girls around me, crying because I don't want to go outside because I hate the way I look and I hate who I am and I hate everything I stand for. You know, I am in the supermarket, like, guarding the 10-item aisle, yelling at people to move to different aisles because they have one too many bananas. And people are like, ma'am, do you even work at the supermarket? I'm like, fucking move. Like, I am like, I am not okay. I'm like thinking about killing you. I'm thinking about killing me. Like, I am homicidal, suicidal, maniacal. Like, and what's so scary about that, maybe the second scariest thing, the first being alcohol stopping working, the second being I have done what everyone has told me my whole life, right? Just stop drinking and stop getting high, Mariel, and your life will get better and you'll be okay. And I am not drinking and I am not getting high and I am anything but okay. And, you know, for whatever reason, I kept coming to these meetings. And I started listening to the people that had, like, those bright, shiny eyes. You know, the people who, you know, because some of you guys are full of shit, and that's just the way it is. But not everybody, you know? And the people who are, like, laughing from their gut. The people who are, like, truly making eye contact with you and giving you, like, a real hug. The people who are, like, smiling genuinely. Like, those are the people that I found attractive, and those are the people that kept me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and those people seem to all be talking about God. So I was like, all right, well, I gotta get this God thing under control then, you know, and so they were talking about the steps, and I would, like, look at them and I'd be like, okay, I could do that. And they're talking about an inventory, so I'm like, okay, so clearly the inventory is the way to God. So I'm going to do an inventory. So being like the go-getter that I am, I was like looking at the big book and like had a notepad and I'm like writing my inventory. And although I highly recommend doing an inventory, I recommend doing it under the direction of a sponsor, because mine was like, you know, all over, and it was zigzag, and it was like resentments and then fear, and then it was like back to my mom, and like it was just a bad time. I get a good chunk of what I think is my inventory done, and I bring it to this woman who is my sponsor, and I'm like very proud, and I'm like sure that like this is the way that I'm gonna get and stay in recovery. And this woman looks at me and she says, you know what, Mariel? I think you're too sick for me, and I think you need to get a new sponsor. And you can ask Jeff. I hated this woman until I was about 5 years sober. I was like, how dare she? You know, and actually at the Acts of Recovery that I spoke at here, I said something really nasty about her at the podium. I really was resentful for years. And I'm so glad that Alcoholics Anonymous and Staying Sober has softened my heart, because I realize that we cannot transmit what we do not have. And her having the humility and the courage to tell me that she could not give me what I desperately needed probably saved my life. Because what happened as a result of that is that evening I went to a young people's meeting and I met a woman who took me through 12 steps, line by line, word for word, you know, and held my hand just long enough to put my hand in God's hand. And, you know, she She gave me a couple like requirements that at the time I didn't really understand. You know, she told me that she wasn't going to be my friend. And I was like, why not? I'm fabulous. Why wouldn't you want to be my friend? Like, and I was really super offended. But she said, like, you're going to call me and we're going to read the book. And when the book says to do something, you're going to do it. And if you don't do it, don't call me. And I was like, you're mean. Like, why are you being so mean to me? And, you know, she also said things like, I'm not going to take you through this work unless you promise me right now you'll take other women through it. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. Like, like, what do you, okay. And like, she asked me, like, was I willing to go to any lengths? And I was like, well, what kind of lengths? Like, what do you mean? But again, I just said yes to all of these things, really, because I just wanted her to like me, right? I didn't know what any of it meant. I was just like, okay, so if I say yes, you'll be my sponsor, then I'll do it. But my experience also at that time was I was so broken by the time I got to her that, like, she could have told me to, like, somersault down Atlantic Avenue naked, like, trying to push a peanut with my, like, with my nose. And, like, I would have given it a try. I probably wouldn't have been very successful, but I would have given it a try. Like, and I always say, like, if you want to surprise someone in AA, do everything they ask of you, you know? Like, and by the time I got to Nuria, I was so broken that, like, I just did what she said. She was like, read, there's a solution. I was like, 25 minutes later, I'm like, all right, done. Like, what's next? And I was just dying. You know, and my prayer for if you're new here is that, like, you're in so much pain it hurts to breathe. And I don't say that because I want you to be in pain. I say that because my experience is that it's not until I'm so devastatingly broken that I'm willing to do some of the really absurd stuff we ask of you here, you know, like stuff that makes no sense. Like, how is sitting down with you and reading this book going to solve my alcohol problem? How is calling women I don't know going to help me? Like, these things that really sounded absurd, I was just willing to do. You know, and I'm going to give you, I guess, a snapshot. I guess I didn't get sober at 8:30. I'm just going to give you a snapshot of the last, you know, almost 9 years and tell you a couple things. So I do anything alcoholically, which means, like, ad nauseum, till I'm so sick of it I don't want to do it anymore. So when I finished the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was absolutely on fire, right? I wanted to help everyone. I wanted to rescue the people who were still drunk. I wanted to, you know, whatever I could do. I wanted to stand on top of the, you know, the Empire State Building and, you know, hold the AA flag and recruit people. Like, I was just all in. And I'm so grateful for that because it probably saved my life. However, what it did is it also ended up hurting me, you know? And I believe we talk a lot about ego in Alcoholics Anonymous. What we don't talk enough about is spiritual ego. And I began to suffer from this delusion that in order to be a good AA member, like, I had to be perfect, right? And my experience is that we're human, and by default, that means we're imperfect. And I began to suffer from the belief that I couldn't tell you guys about what was really going on. In order to be a good sponsor, in order to be a good AA speaker, in order to be a good member, I couldn't tell you guys about the fact that I was still broken. And so what that did for me is it made me live a double life. You know, and our book talks about the alcoholic lives a double life and yearns to have a reputation that his character does not deserve or something like that. And my experience is that that's not only drunk, that that's sober as well. And here I am living this double life in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, flying around the country and talking at different AA meetings and sponsoring a whole bunch of girls and, you know, doing all of this stuff. And I'm like dying. I'm dying in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've fallen asleep once again. And, you know, active in an eating disorder, in an abusive relationship, like, getting home from, you know, speaking at the podium and, like, crawling into the fetal position in my closet because I'm in so much pain, you know, like, not wanting to drink but seriously considering killing myself and terrified to tell you guys what's going on, you know, because you might, like, not want me to be a member of AA anymore, you know, you know, Bill talks about in some of his writings outside of the big book. He talks about, as brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous, we are attracted to each other by our imperfections, not our perfections. And my experience is that, thank God, someone was put in my life at that time, before I got into enough pain to kill myself, that that talked openly from the podium about being sober and being crazy. And I think that actually might have been at this meeting. And this woman was just very transparent about how not okay she was. And I'll be honest, I found that really attractive because I was really not okay, you know. And what I was able to relearn, you know, or unlearn, was that, like, I don't have to be perfect here in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I need to be honest about how imperfect I am, and that I can do just about anything and stay sober. Not that I'm recommending that you do all sorts of heinous stuff, but the one thing I really can't do is lie to you guys about what's going on. You know, and I have a lot of experience about, you know, making wrong decisions sober, you know, like getting involved with a newcomer, stealing from the AA seventh tradition, you know, using my mother's credit card without her permission, cheating in school, like doing all of these things that are, you know, not becoming of like a sober woman of grace and dignity, whatever that means, you know. And I'm not saying that you might do those things and get drunk. I don't know. But I know that for me, what I can't do is lie to you guys about what's going on. Because what that does is it separates me from you. And that's what my alcoholism wants, right? Because when I'm around you guys see me in my spiritual blind spot, right? As long as I'm being transparent with you guys. And if I have the thought, hey, maybe you should have a drink, Marielle, which sometimes happens, I'm an alcoholic, right? It's fleeting and it leaves, right? My response to that is, that's a stupid idea. Let's keep it moving, right? Whereas when I'm far enough away from you guys, living only in my spiritual blind spot, the idea of, hey, you should have a drink, just might sound attractive. So the way my alcoholism talks to me now is things like, you don't really need them. Or they won't understand you. Or your life is so good, you can do less AA. Or, you know, you don't need to really sponsor people. Or you don't need to allow yourself to be sponsored. Those are the things that my alcoholism tells me today. And those are the things that I need to watch for in an effort to continue doing the things that got me sober are the things I need to continue doing to stay sober. And, you know, what I'll just close with is I'll tell you guys a little bit about what my life looks like now, you know, like what it really looks like, which is extraordinary. And I think that's really important because thank God I heard people when I first got here talk about the really cool shit they'd gotten, you know, because that was attractive. And, you know, I moved to New Jersey a couple years ago, and I'll just say this. Moving in sobriety is the hardest thing I've ever done. And if I can ask you one thing, I think we're very well trained with the person who raises their hand and says, hey, I'm new, I have one day, or hey, I'm coming back, you know? And my plea would be, can we be a little bit more aware of not only whose first day it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, but maybe whose last day it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And that I really needed to be loved by you guys, and my alcoholism told me I didn't need you guys. You know, I moved to New Jersey, and the life I've, you know, fallen into in the last 3 years is absolutely beyond, you know, anything that I, you know, wildest dreams could have imagined, didn't even know I wanted, you know. And these things involve like getting engaged, getting into grad school, you know, graduating college and being asked to be the commencement speaker, you know, like having a career that like I get raises, you know, like, you know, like I'm asked to come back, you know, like being trusted with keys to my mother's house. Like she just went to South Carolina and asked me to come house sit and watch her dogs, you know, like having meaningful friendships with people who like don't care about how much money I have, you know, they only just want to do activities, you know, and like that's the stuff that I didn't know that I wanted. You know, that's the stuff that allows me to be full in sobriety. And most importantly, you know, what I have is I have the ability to, like, walk through the day and be pretty okay with what I'm working with most of the time. Not all of the time, but all I ever wanted when I was drinking was to just be okay most of the time. And by coming here and staying here and doing the things that my sponsor tells me to do pretty regularly, you know, I get to have that pretty regularly. Thanks for letting me share.